What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Rentimental Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Hartwell, and it's been a minute. It's been a few months, but I'm happy to say that I have some episodes banked up that I'm getting ready to release, and I'm really excited about that. I love podcasting. It's always on my mind. It's something I love to do, and it's been a busy past few months. You'll hear me mention it a little bit in my conversation with Aaron, but I started a new job. I had a lot of stuff going on with the Texans drumline. Man, it's been a whirlwind, to say the least. And to be honest with you, I've had trouble incorporating the podcast schedule into my everyday life, but I think I finally cracked the code. So big things are coming. I'm ready to take this thing to the moon, as the kids would say. And yeah, I met Aaron at the Midwest Clinic in December in Chicago. And I met him through Drew, our friend Drew Tucker, who's been on a couple times. And yeah, man, we hit it off immediately. We went and got coffee and lunch with Drew. And I wasn't even supposed to be there, to be honest with you. I think they were meeting about something else. But Aaron and I just ended up talking most of the time. And it was a really good time. And I'm glad he came on. So Aaron works for Hal Leonard. We talk about that a little bit. He was a band director before up in New York State. And yeah, talk about his Eastman time a little bit. And it's just a really, really good conversation and all about the focus of being an artist, an educator, all of the above. So without further ado, here's Aaron Stabell.
So is this, do people watch the video as well, or is it all the audio?
So I've put up probably like half of them have been video as well.
Okay. I mean, that's fine.
Yeah. I like to cut it up and put it on YouTube most of the time.
Oh, nice. No, there's nothing embarrassing in my background, really. I don't think.
Well, there is in mine. I got these boxes because I just moved, but.
No, that's good though. That's the moving's always the hardest thing, right?
It's pretty brutal, but.
You got the mallets up though. That's the key.
Yeah, that's the main thing. The I made those probably like. I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, and they've been with me all over the place. They've been with me to Vegas, Louisiana, Houston, like,
they're nice. Travel they, well. Are those, like, metal grommets at the top, and then you just hang them on hooks?
Yeah. Yeah, they're IKEA shoe organizers.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah, and then I put brass brads to make the mallets not flop out, you know.
Oh, that's smart. Good work.
Shout out to YouTube. Actually, I think I stole that idea from Adam Tan. He's a YouTuber.
Oh yeah, I've seen Adam before.
Yeah.
Great player.
Really good player and really good idea for organizing mallets. But forgive me, I'm in my work polo, so I'm.
No, not at all. This is my work attire.
Yeah, way
too.
Fresher than me though. Way fresher than
today. Well, because you know, actually, it's funny. I thought I was gonna have a call with a customer this morning. So I got on my nice shirt, and then it ended up being tomorrow. So I'm going to have to choose a different one for tomorrow.
Isn't it interesting how much even the music industry workforce has changed? Like,
yeah.
I couldn't believe you told me, because we met at Midwest, thanks to Drew Tucker. But I couldn't believe you told me that your job was remote. Like, it's just hard to believe that is the case in the music industry still.
It's amazing. And, you know, we were just on a call about Midwest, actually, kind of like a recap for the whole company. And they said it was actually a really good thing that everybody was, now not everybody's working remotely, just our education team is, but some folks work in Minnesota, right at the factory or the warehouse for Hal Leonard. And then the corporate offices are in Milwaukee. And then different parts of other teams are different parts of the country. So they said, this is the first time that they've really been able to have everybody in one meeting because everybody's work can do it virtually. You know, right, it's actually like kind of an advantage. So that's it's pretty strange. Cool.
I mean, like, it's not strange. It's actually super efficient, but I didn't think the music industry would ever, in any facet, I never thought it would go that route, but it had to. Yeah. So,
well, and I think I remember back, cause I've only been doing this job since July and I was a band director before that. And when things were a little bit, you know, COVID, we were coming back, but it wasn't fully back. We would have like our faculty meetings on Zoom, even though everybody was in the same building, just to keep, you know, keep the exposures down if there were any. And it was great. It was so much more efficient. Like you could, you know, catch up on something else if you weren't paying attention. You didn't need to pay attention to that part instead of like, you know, aimlessly doodling in a notebook or something. You know, could actually make use of your time. So there are, I think, a lot of advantages to the remote workforce. And I think that sometimes, you know, there's no commute. So like I can just start digging in when I'm ready to start. And I can keep working late if I need to. I think both sides get something out of it, you know, the employer and the worker.
How's the work life balance now compared? Cause I'm in a high school band director position. So like, I know my work life balance isn't exactly what I would want it to be, but.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's better for me than it was. I was a district coordinator in my last position, part-time, half and half. Mm-hmm. So I was teaching and doing this coordinator stuff and I liked it, but you know, right now there's a lot more flexibility. My kids are 5 and 7, which is, you know, they kind of, it's good to have somebody at home to be able to go, you know, pick them up if they get sick or, you know, just even simple stuff like it, you know, I can throw in the dishwasher, the next batch of dishes in the dishwasher. It takes 2 minutes, you know?
Right.
And if I'm here and I go upstairs to go to the bathroom or whatever, and I go past the dishwasher, you know, I think we're just a little more efficient at home right now. And you know, I've been trying hard to, be thoughtful about not working late, you know? So like when the day's over, I try to close my computer and not think about stuff until the next day.
Right.
So far so good.
If there was some way, like so many of my friends don't work, they don't do anything involved with music or anything involved with drums for that matter. And so like, and they talk about their work from home experience and their remote experience. And it's like, man, like this big thing now, it seems like in the workforce is this work-life balance. Like the people care more about mental health, which is a really good thing.
Absolutely.
And everything. And so like, it's seeming like, I was telling my coworker this the other day, the world is just, it's changing. It's becoming tech is more integrated than it ever has been before. And it makes me wonder what drumming and what music is going to look like. Like, I know it's already changed because of coronavirus and because of Houston rappers having concerts that kill people, but there's something I think about this more often than I ever have before. Like, what is it going to look like? I have no idea if the industry side of things has already changed. What is the performing and the education side of things going to look like? You know?
Yeah. Well, I loved I was one of those people who wasn't disappointed to be locked down in our house. We were really lucky and we had, you know, able to get everything that we needed. And we connected as a family on a deeper level than we ever had before. It was cool. That's beautiful. I loved being able to watch concerts and stuff. You know, people would do a concert where there were no audience in person, but they would record it. And, you know, I probably watched more music and listened to more music, but specifically watching concerts. Because they were all available online now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like I live right here in Rochester, Eastman School of Music. To get there, it's a 7-minute drive from my house.
And
at least one, if not several, world-class performances every week, you know. But to get out the door and drive down there and find a parking space and go through the whole thing, it's just like sometimes for an introvert like me, sometimes it's just too much, you know. Right, like, right. I'd love to see the wind ensemble play Lincolnshire Posy, but I'd also love to just like keep these slippers on.
Of course.
And when I watch a virtual concert, I can do both of those.
Right.
So I actually think it's cool. And some of my friends, I have this friend named John Fadham. He plays drums for Sarah Jaroche. You know that singer? She's a really, really great singer.
I'll have to look her up. I've never heard
of her. She's awesome. Very like folky. So John was a classmate of mine at Eastman. He plays drums with her band, but he's also got his own project called Jackson Port, singer-songwriter thing. Wonderful stuff.
Cool.
And he did a cool concert where, you know, you had to buy like a virtual ticket, you know, so you'd pay $5 and then that would unlock.
Yeah, paywall.
That you could go. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, while I really appreciated all the free stuff that I watched, obviously, I didn't have a problem, you know, paying the $10 or whatever it was. And then he could talk to you while you're, you know, while he was at, it was as close to being at a live concert as could be without actually setting foot in the place, you know?
Right.
So I hope that some of those things get refined because, it is really cool to be able to check stuff out that, you know, the downside of living in Rochester is that if there's a gig at, you know, Smalls in New York City, like, I can't watch that in person. I can watch their live stream though, you know, or.
And Rochester's not, cool. It's not close to New York City, right?
No. I mean, you could go get there in a day, but it's definitely a 6 hour.
Right.
So, no matter which way you cut it. But, you know, I watched like Third Coast did a ton of cool programming over the COVID shutdown. And that was great. And especially great for my kids, right? Because I'm not going to take my 5-year-old son to a Third Coast concert in person, probably.
Right.
But we could watch 15 minutes or whatever stamina he had at home from the couch. And then, you know, he could go in the other room and I can keep watching. And that's right. It was a really, some really good evenings spent just checking out. So, you know, my daughter who's 7, like started getting into the Ring cycle, you know, she's like, what happens next? I'm like, well, it's another 5 hours of watching
before we
get to the end of this. But like, that was so cool, but I could never take her to that concert in person.
You know, right.
We would make it 30 minutes or something. So there was a lot of good stuff that happened. And I hope that those things don't go away. Like, I love playing a live concert. I love getting, you know, in front of people or watching a band in person, but I hope that there are still some options for that stuff as we, you know, get back to whatever normal is going to look like. Cause it's cool to be able to reach audiences all over the place.
Yeah. That format is going to help. It's going to help any kind of weird genre, like, percussion ensemble is not weird to us, but to the
it is weird,
but to the non-musician, well, especially some contemporary pieces, but to the non-musician, like, it could really help. Like, if somebody has a strong social media presence, even if you're not interested in the matter in which they are involved in, you still want to follow them because it's like quality content, right? Like, it's like, you know.
Yeah, well, that idea of small bites is so crucial because I think, you know, if you try to invite somebody, like I did these concerts, I haven't done one in a while, but solo drum set concerts.
Yeah.
You know, and to you, that probably sounds really interesting, but to a lot of people, they're like, it's just going to be you playing drums by yourself for like 1 hour.
Yeah, can you play Back in Black?
That's a hard sell, man. You know, and I've got some great friends in town that were very supportive of some of those shows, but you know, it's not for everybody. But if you put one piece online, you know, and you divide them up on YouTube or whatever, you know, 5 minutes is tolerable for people, you know, or even like I started doing TikTok now.
Yeah.
You know, and just like 30-second clips, like, that's usually at least something that most people can dig into a little bit more easily. Then there's not that huge commitment of like, you know, nobody's going to come to my live drum set concert and walk out after the first piece, hopefully, you know.
Yeah, right.
So that, like, well, it makes it a little easier to commit to checking it out too.
Well, and too, like, I like how you said small doses. I mean, people's attention spans are low anyway nowadays, but
yeah.
I find myself, even mine being low, you know, it's kind of, it's strange. I always kind of tried to stay away from that direction that we were going to, but I find myself just kind of being like, man, even like practicing, I'm like, all right, how long have I been doing this? Oh my God. It's only been a minute, like, you know, or something. Yeah. Like, not that exaggerated, but.
No, but it is sometimes. See, I was talking to my sister-in-law this morning and she recommended a book. And I was like, I don't know if I can make it through a book. You know, I mean, like, really totally serious, just because, you know, there, it's hard. There are a lot of distractions, and there, even with books, there are a lot of things to choose from. And so, you know, unless I'm really excited about it, it's sometimes tough. Now, that's not really a good thing to admit, but, you know, and I think a lot of people, my wife reads a lot of books, and that's good. But, you know, like, I remember being at PASIC. And were you at PASIC? I don't know.
We had not this year. I went 2019, okay. But not this year.
Yes. So, you know, it was great as always. And Ivan and I performed his Strive to Be Happy piece. And we do it sometimes where I'll read the Desiderata text and he plays, you know.
Oh, I didn't know that. I've played that piece before.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. So check it out. Because there's like, I don't want to say like he wrote it for me, but the notes in the piece talk about how I showed him this poem, this Desiderata by Max Ehrman, and he was inspired to write that piece. And so, yeah, we've done it like, I don't know, probably 4 or 5 times, different places where he'll play the piece. And while he plays the piece, there's actually a good YouTube of it from PASIC a couple of years back. And I'll just read the poem as he plays. It's really great, special moment for me to be able to do that with a friend. But we did that piece on one of these focus concerts this past year. So there were like 5 or 6 performances prior to ours. And then his was at the end, and he played one of his songbook tunes. And then we did this Strive to Be Happy together. And it just made me think of, you know, the legendary Steve Schick performed a piece on that concert. And it was probably like 20 minutes long. And it was, you know, it was incredible. He had the whole thing memorized. It was, you know.
That's on brand, yeah.
Yeah, very much like, you know, the other stuff that I've seen him do. Very, you know, pretty esoteric in moments. It was for like 2 sort of setups. One, for some of the time he played a bass drum and a gong and maybe something else. And then he would go over to the vibes and play. Mm. And then the whole concert was anything that you used percussion and voice. So he would also recite text throughout this piece. I can look back and find out the title of the piece.
Some yeah, I'm curious. I'm curious if it's the one I'm it. Thinking of.
It was really cool. But anyway, you know, I remember sitting there and imagining my mom at that concert, if she was there, being like, oh man, back to the vibes again, you know, like, and it was great. I mean, the performance was fantastic. And, you know, just to be able to even perform on the same concert as Steve was a real honor. But to your point, you know, sitting through that piece for in a different audience might have been a lot more challenging.
Right.
And so, you know, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is, yeah, you're right. Like, the attention span thing is a real issue. And I think especially with contemporary music, we see longer and longer pieces. And I think that that goes kind of against what's happening in society. Yeah. I mean, I'm mainly a jazz drummer. And I think that that's one of the biggest critiques that people could give of jazz too, is that the tunes sometimes go on forever. Yeah. I mean, like, how many choruses?
I mean, I get the trading aspect, the solo section aspect, the let's play the head again, okay, let's go back, you know, like, your turn.
Yeah.
Even as a musician, I don't have a complete background in jazz, but like, it makes me always wonder, and maybe you can speak on this a little bit. What does the non-musician who loves jazz, what do they get out of it? What do they?
It's a great question.
Do they appreciate the artisanship? Do they appreciate the skill? Like, because I mean, even as a musician, some of it's, you know, you're listening to it, you're like, this is an effort to listen to.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, I think that, you know, and when we get into this conversation, it's a great conversation, but it's important to say first that within jazz, there are so many different subgenres, right? So it's hard to just like lump all of it together.
Correct. Yeah.
But I think in a lot of contexts, jazz, it almost becomes like feats of strength. You know, like, you're like, wow, this guy, you know, like, people talk about legendary performances in jazz history, and they talk about, like, Paul Gonzalez with Duke Ellington playing diminuendo and crescendo in blue at the Newport Jazz Festival. And he took like 37 choruses on the blues or something like that.
Yeah.
And people talk about it. And when people refer to how great that performance was, they always reference how long he played for. Now, it's burning. Like, every single moment of it was great, great playing. But, like, it's important that that qualification is put forth. Or when you talk about, like, John Coltrane playing these, like, you know, 20-minute epic things, this is all part of it. I think what people like is to see, you know, how someone can continue to be creative for that amount of time, you know, without running out of ideas, essentially.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That's one thing that I think people get out of it. But I mean, everybody's different. I think that, for me, sometimes that stuff does get too long. You know, I think about, I have a band, oh, several bands that play around town and beyond. And I'm always thinking about, I always want to kind of, like, get it wrapped up. You know, I don't want the song to go on for, you know, 10 minutes is reasonable if it's a longer composition. But I think more than that, it's very hard for people. And some of my heroes are great improvisers who will play like 45 minutes, just the whole band is improvising together. And in those cases, especially, what I'm impressed by is not so much what's coming out, but the process that they're going through as musicians. Like, I'm kind of watching them solve a puzzle in a sense, right? So, like, one guy I really, he's become a good friend now, but one of my real heroes is the sax player named Tony Malady. And he's great at this. Like, he can just go and have his band improvise for an hour. And that's the concert.
It's a conversation, a very complex conversation. And I think I'm friends with a lot of vibraphone players, it seems like. I guess I just gravitate towards them. But Drew and my friend James Whiting, these guys are able to have a full-on musical conversation on this this instrument that is extremely niche. Like, not a lot of people are maestros at that instrument, especially in the jazz context. And whenever I watch a quartet or a trio and they're trading and they're having a conversation, I think the main thing that I think about is the journey that their lives brought them on to this point, to the point to where they're so fluent in that conversation style, that's fascinating to me, even because I know what my musical journey has brought me to. And it's like, what, it's almost like they're telling their story every time they play.
Sure.
And it just makes me wonder, like, that's why I asked, what is the guy who's wearing the fedora and smoking a cigar at the dispensary in Las Vegas who doesn't play anything, what does he get out of this, right?
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because I did a thing last night, and it was a little hard to explain, but old friend of mine named Ike Sturm, great bass player, he leads this group of folks who meet once a week on Zoom. And they're all creative-minded people. So they're either writers or artists or musicians or something. Not necessarily for a career, but that's what they're into.
Right.
And they meet, and then there's a guest. So, like, I was the guest. And they just talk about, you know, how to be creative. And they ask questions. What does it feel like when you're starting to play an improvised drum solo or whatever? But we discovered this really cool thing last night that I think kind of goes to your point. And so they'll have a prompt, and, like, so the woman will say, Aaron's going to play something now. And then I want you to think about being on a road. You're on a road and you're standing in the middle of the road looking at the yellow lines. And then what does the music make you think of? You know, like, what comes next? And it was so interesting because I played a piece that I was working on. I played it on piano, this thing I've been writing for a little while. And almost every person's answer was, you know, pretty much the same, you know? And even though nobody had any context for it, nobody had any, I didn't explain anything about the piece. And everybody's answer was kind of the same. I mean, with some variation.
Right.
And so I said to everybody, I said, that's really interesting that we all sort of got to the same place pretty quickly on that. And somebody else commented. They said, yeah, I think that's a lot of what I get out of listening to this kind of music, is that there's sort of like, without words, it still has a message.
Right.
It still has a way to put people in a certain place. And so I think that people who listen to jazz like that really enjoy, you know, going those places themselves, mentally or emotionally. But also, I think there's something pretty cool about a collective group of people being able to, whether they actually declare this out loud or not as they're listening, but everybody's kind of taking the same journey together. You know, they're having, sharing the experience together. I'm sure that not a lot of people are talking about like, oh, did you hear that sick F sharp that he played in the third measure of a, you know, that's not the kind of thing people are preoccupied with. And I wish performers were less preoccupied with worrying about that stuff. You know,
it's tough.
Just trying to, yeah, just trying to, like,
reteach yourself how to listen.
Right. Like, yeah. Well, with, just like how to avoid judging what you're doing, you know, yeah, just like going with the flow.
It's critique fatigue. Really, I mean,
yeah,
I feel it.
It took a long time for me to come out of music school and feel like I could just do whatever I wanted musically and not have to worry about someone telling me it was a bad choice.
Right.
You know, even either zoomed in or from a really large perspective. But it, you know, I'm almost comfortable with myself, and it's been 20 years, so we'll see.
Yeah, yeah, it's comfortability in a style that you're not used to as well. Like I said, I'm not traditionally trained jazz, but like I have more interest in playing jazz than I ever have before. And I think it's nice. Because I wasn't interested in it up until the point where I was so focused on the orchestral and the classical and the drum set part of the non-jazz drum set part of things that I was like,
yeah,
this, I mean, the past couple of years has shifted everyone's mindsets, especially creatives. But I think now it's like, I want to explore every avenue. Like what, like this guy who has a jazz background, I want to know what he thinks as a creative.
Yeah.
I want to know how a proficient jazzer, if you want to say that term, can, I want to know their process, their creative process, and how do I incorporate that into informing my own identity, which is...
Well, that's a great question too, yeah.
That's a tough one. It's a deep-rooted question that I think all musicians have, is like, how do I create... Like Vinnie Caliuta was talking about in an interview with Don Famularo. He was like, I was trying so hard to be rudimental, and I was trying so hard to sound like these guys. Right. I was trying so hard to sound like Tony and all these influences that he had on himself. And eventually he was like, how do I, even Vinnie Caliuta had to be like, how do I sound like myself? How do I create my own identity? Which is so profound, you know.
It's hard. And the more time that passes, the harder it is, because there's more things that have been done, right? You know, like more people who have done the thing. To go back to what you were saying about like the worrying about the right note and stuff, I think that is actually what got me on the path to focusing more on jazz, because I was, you know, probably a lot like you and a lot of other of our friends. At first, I just thought I was going to be in the New York Phil, you know, like when I was in middle school, I was really getting serious. And then as I got into high school, I was still really serious about, you know, mallet stuff. And I would sight read, mallet books and other instruments and stuff in the hallway of our music wing during lunch and stuff like that. I just really was into it.
Yeah.
And then my teacher, who was named Jack Brennan, he's in the Indianapolis Symphony now, but he was in the Buffalo Philharmonic when I was a kid. He was my teacher, my first like serious teacher. He moved and took another job somewhere. And so I was kind of without a teacher. And my dad, who's a good bass player, he was friends with Rich Thompson, who was teaching at Eastman. Mm. And my dad said, why don't you go take a lesson with Rich and just see what it's like? And I thought I was going to still play like coal grass snare drum solos and stuff for him. And I tried to, and he's like, yeah, I don't really do that. You know, like I kind of, I want to work, let's play this Duke Ellington record together.
Oh, man.
And I loved it. But, you know, then I started to think about it more, and I was like, you know, what's cool about the drums versus trying to learn, you know, marimba repertoire or something, because I was still doing that sort of on my own as a high school student. And I was like, man, you know, like getting it just perfect is really hard.
Right.
And being, you know, and like, I was,
oh, I know.
You know, right, of course. I mean, yeah, everybody. And, you know, like even still today, I'm really, really focused on the big picture in life, almost to a fault. You know, I'm pretty bad with details.
Mm-hmm.
So,
whereas I'm overly detailed.
Yeah, that's probably what makes you so successful, though. Like, we were trying to post some shoes on eBay the other night. My wife and I, we had said, like, our son had these boots he never wore. Like, yeah, maybe we get $20 for him or something, you know? And I had the wrong size on the thing, like, 4 times. You know, and like, you know, I was like, how am I not? And every time she'd be like, it's still wrong. It's still wrong. Like, man, I just am not a details person. Yeah. And so it would not have made sense for me to continue pursuing a path that was, you know, really detail focused, I think.
Yeah.
And so I still have a great appreciation for that. You know, I taught a lot of drum lines and stuff where the details really matter. And yeah, I can get into it for sure, but it's not necessarily where I feel I'm strongest. And so being able to play some music where there was no necessarily correct answer, or where the answer had to come more from me than from a composer, was really attractive. And then that's the path I continued on. And then Rich took me from high school and got me, you know, to the point where I could get into Eastman. And then that's what I did. I was there for 6 years playing the drums.
I mean,
in the jazz department.
Oh, in the jazz department, right. And so,
yeah, I was a jazz major, and all of my friends, like, you know, that's how I know Ivan, and, you know, people like Rob Sandrill and George Clements and Mark Bozeman and all of these friends of ours, you know, I mean, I could go on and on about all the great folks that I spent time at Eastman with, but almost all my friends were percussion majors, not right. jazz drum set majors. So it was studios 4 times the size and all that stuff. But there was always this thing about how, like, you know, I was working on very different stuff than they were working on, you know, whether it was when John Beck was there, or when I came back to do my master's, was when Mike Burritt was there. I had just kind of got there, and I was just working on really different stuff. You know, I was working on transcriptions that other drummers had played, and then figuring out pretty quickly how to make that into my own vocabulary. And, you know, meanwhile, somebody else was like shedding time on marimba super hard, trying to get it exactly right. And there was a lot, yeah. there was a lot of interesting discussions that we would have about that, you know, or like I would go hear the percussion ensemble rehearse, and somebody would say, oh, that's not the right mallet for, you know, whatever piece they're playing. And right. I would sort of like play dumb and be like, what do you mean? It's not, how is there like a right mallet? It doesn't even say on the piece what mallet to use. So maybe that sounds good to me, you know, not being as steeped in the literature as some people were. You know, I hadn't heard 6 versions of this piece performed like some of my peers had. And I was like, I don't know, that sounds fine. So why don't you ever use the rubber ones? Those sound good. And then people would like laugh and be like, oh yeah, no, you never use those. Like, well, it's just a different sound. It's not a bad sound. The term
I always hear is the right sound. And it's like,
right. But what's the right sound?
There exactly.
Is no right sound.
The
you
subjective.
Know? It's just,
yeah, it's subjective. It's, I mean,
it's kind of community built, right? Like the
correct,
community
yeah.
sort of establishes what the norms are. And there are some things like that in the drum set community too. I mean, you know, if you go to a concert and see somebody playing like clear heads, you know, that's usually a pretty strong indicator of what type of music you're about to hear. And it's probably not 1960s bebop.
Oh, no, probably not.
Or poorly executed if it is. But, you know, there are some things like that, but I think there's a lot more room, you know, in terms of like stick choice. And I mean, what type of sticks a drummer uses is actually really interesting. to me. And when you look on, you know, Vic Firth or whatever, you know, how many signature drumsticks there are versus how many signature marimba mallets, I bet you there are a lot more signature drumsticks, because that's such a defining characteristic of somebody's sound. I was always really into that, actually, as a student and still today. So that's just one of many ways that there was this divide kind of between the jazz majors and the percussion majors. And it wasn't a contentious divide at all, but it was definitely that we were on different wavelengths.
It makes you think, like, how does someone like Brian Blade use an ST2 Bolero? And it's like, I think probably stick choice is for, like, if I tried to explain stick choice to a kid who's just in band in my program just to be in band, like, they're not gonna, like, I'm like, well, Brian, you know, Brian Blake can get away with ST2s on jazz drums and whatever, and it's like, we can go and rant and rave about this all that we can, but it just comes down to, like, how your hands are even made up, the physical makeup of your hands, and how do we use them as vehicles to make the best sounds that we possibly can? And it's
that's a great point.
But then what is the best sound?
Right.
And then what is sound? Like, it just,
that's something, you know, when I think about the amount of time that, like, you know, we said friends of mine put in on this marimba repertoire or whatever. One of the things I was spending a lot of time on was actually what my sound is. Mm-hmm. You know, and I, you know, I'll play a gig and use three or four different models of sticks through over the course of the gig. Maybe not, you know, I have some that are really good all purpose. You know, I love the Peter Erskine ride stick that Vic Firth makes. I think that's really top notch, super versatile. But you know, there are times when I want a different color, or I want a different tool, just the same way a classical person does.
Right.
But also really, like, I think I spend just as much time thinking about sound as somebody preparing for an orchestral audition. It's just a different context. But one of the things I take the most pride in about my playing is my sound. I think it's a very well-developed and unique sound. And it's something I really think I'm proud of. And there are not a whole lot of things where I would say that about, but the sound is a huge one for me. And you know, I remember going to hear one of my heroes is this drummer named Jorge Rossi, who used to play a lot with Brad Meldow in his trio. And when I was coming up, that was like the band, you know?
Right.
So I went to the Village Vanguard as a college student and sat as close as I could to Jorge and watched him play. And man, I was like, how does he get this sound? You know, and he was doing so many things way different than a lot of other people. He was using like a really thick ride cymbal. And then he was using these huge sticks that were like almost like drumline sticks, like gigantic. And he was choked up almost halfway on the stick, playing like just incredible, you know, like the stuff I had heard on the records a million times. And I was like, well, yeah, that makes sense, because he's like doing it totally differently than I would have ever thought to do it. And that sort of got my mind thinking about, you know, the sound. And then I started thinking about another drummer I love named Bill Stewart. And Zildjian came out with...
I love Bill Stewart, man.
Bill Stewart is so good.
I can watch him play Zildjian came out
with the Bill Stewart sticks when I was in college. And so immediately I was like, yep, got to get those right away. You know, and they're so thin. So thin. Maybe the thinnest stick on the market. And I started playing with them and I was like, this makes sense. I do sound a little bit more like Bill Stewart using these sticks, you know? So it's all still the same kind of stuff that people are thinking about when they try 40 different triangles or whatever. It's the same thing. And cymbals, I mean, my gosh, like the personal choice with cymbal and ride cymbals is, I mean, legendary. You know, Roy Haynes' flat ride from Now He Sings, Now He Sobs is like, should be in the Smithsonian.
Right.
You know, it's just like, that's the sound. So
it all boils down to, I just think, like, when I think of somebody like Dan Weiss, who I watch on Instagram I would call him a modern maestro.
Absolutely.
The fact that we get to watch this guy, watch him post videos of his practice.
Yeah.
And I think of somebody like Bill Stewart, I think of somebody like Tony, or I think of somebody like you know, Roy Haynes, and who has a grandson who is a reincarnation, and then has his own sound of who Marcus he is.
Just incredible.
We get to watch these people, man. We get to watch them. Even in this is the blessing of the modern society, and it has its curses. But watching Dan Weiss's practice videos gets me hyped up, and it's like, and you talk about symbols. Like, I think symbol choice is important, but a guy like that can make a symbol sound, any kind of symbol sound, good. Right. It's like how Peter Erskine can make quarter notes swing.
I was gonna say that, like, you know, I remember Jack DeJohnette came to Eastman when I was in my undergrad and talked about traveling through Europe and playing house kits, and how, you know, depending on the country and the city you were in, you might get a really terrible house kit, but people still expected Jack DeJohnette, you know. So learning, and he talked about his practice methods for making sure that that was achievable, and he would like practice really like tuning his floor tom almost flat, so like there was no rebound at all, and
wow,
like he would still try to play his same routine and try to make it work, you know. And so yeah, that's a thing too, like people have that expectation. So if you, when you are Brian Blade and you show up at every gig and it's a different drum set, like people still want Brian Blade.
Yeah.
And so yeah, there's it's not just about the gear, it's a something that I think you have to work on, and just like you would in an orchestra, like this is my approach and this is how I get that sound. And having, you know, talk to sax players, I mean, that's like an obsession for so many sax players, is the mouthpiece and the setup and the reed and then the sound, and like they just work on sound for a really long time. And I think that in education and younger students and stuff, it's so neglected. You know, I think that sound is something that people just don't even think about. They're just like, okay, well, I can, you know, like, here's what those people will say to me, like, what beat are you playing? You know, can I learn? I was like, well, yeah, but I can show you the notes, but like, man, you've also got to think about the fact that you've got to create the same sound, or vice versa. I can look at a Steve Gadd transcription and play the right notes and not sound a damn thing like Steve does, you know. It's like there's so much more to it than what the rhythm is. There's a whole lot of other stuff going on there.
We can take and make our own concoction of techniques. You know, what my teachers always said is the toolbox, right? But we don't talk about a toolbox of sound.
Yeah.
Like how can I mix in this Steve Gadd snare drum sound with my own? Like how can I, it's almost like in music education, that's hard though. Like, you know, and it's like, it's almost like you have to mask it with in some way to get the kid to understand, like, this is, or maybe not even understand it. It's like, just kind of give it to him an opportunity to discover sound and be like, this is, you'll look back at this one day and be like, oh, okay, I see what he was doing here, but it may be a while.
Let's take a quick second to pause the episode to talk about how you can support the podcast even further. Thank you for listening, for one thing, but another thing is how you can support is a monthly subscription to the podcast. It's just 99 cents a month. It goes directly to me, and I can use that money to buy more equipment, video equipment, recording equipment, and it goes directly back into the podcast. So if you could click that support link in the description below, I would greatly appreciate it. Back to the episode.
Well, because it's about the outcome so much in music education, right? Like, I would imagine you probably teach a marching band in Texas, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, you can't go out there and say, well, they've all played with a good sound, but nobody plays together. Like, you wouldn't be the guy anymore, right? Like, it has to be a certain level of achievement. And where I learned a lot of this sound stuff was in situations where the outcome was either didn't matter, like it wasn't an outcome based process, so maybe like a master class or just like a class that I was going to take, or in situations where that was the point, you know, like where I went to a lesson with somebody so that I could learn how to sound like them. Like one time I went to this great workshop in Brooklyn with Tony Malaby as one of the teachers, and then the other teacher was John Hollenbeck, who's also become a real mentor to me over the last, you know, 15, 20 years, whatever. Great drummer. He lives right now in Montreal. He teaches at McGill in Montreal.
Oh, wow.
He's just fantastic. Like, if people listening haven't checked out John's work, that would be the first thing you should do after this.
Is he related to Eric Hollenbeck?
I don't think so. He's related to Pat Hollenbeck, who was in like the Boston Symphony for a while. It's his brother.
Eric he's at Colorado State.
Yeah, maybe like distantly, but no, John's not that I'm aware of. But anyway, I went to this workshop and John was like, okay, I want you to practice sound. And so he said what he does is he puts a composition book next to his drum set. And every time he creates a new sound, he writes down, like, he tries to name it, if he can name it or describe it, and how he achieved the sound very specifically, right? Like, not like I hit the floor tom. Like, I used, 3 inches from the tip of my stick and hit the cymbal on the edge at 75% velocity, like really specific.
Right.
And then he can go back and replicate that again. And so he said, okay, so here's your challenge. Here's a snare drum and one drumstick. I want you to come up with as many unique sounds as you can in 30 seconds. Ready, set, go. And I came up with like three. I was like, well, you could hit it. And then I could hit it with my hand. And then, I was 19 or whatever I was doing. And then he took the same equipment and got to like, 20 in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
See, I mean, he had worked on it. It was a little bit unfair. But the point is, it's just like that creativity and that exploration that he had done. And when you're in a situation where you have to make the donuts and you only have a certain amount of time to make them, then that's an easy one to let fall by the wayside, right?
Yeah.
Like some of my pals who teach really good drum lines, when you talk about like stick height, right? Like, that's a really fast way to teach dynamics.
Right.
Because there's no wiggle room. It's like, this is 6 inches and this is 6 inches. And if you do it following the right technique and everybody has the right gear and stuff, it will sound the same. That's a really cool thing. I've thought about a lot, but
It's up for debate on how effective that is. And
interesting. Oh, I'd like to know about that.
Well, it's like, people are like, I don't teach, because the concept of sound has entered the drumline world. The concept of,
oh, good.
I mean,
I was not aware.
Like high school level in Texas, especially, because if you look at these high school drumlines that are top in the state, they win state, they go to BOA, like Cedar Park or Cedar Ridge or Leander or Vandegrift for Joe Hobbs.
Claudia Johnson,
Taylor Johnson. Yeah.
I was at BOA this year.
Yeah, there you go.
Because I was and some of those groups are just, man, my goodness. And yeah.
The fact that these kids understand sound and how you achieve it on a marching drum is probably one of the greatest feats that's been accomplished in the marching percussion history. Because it's not just about ramming notes anymore. It's like, how do you sound when you're ramming these notes? Like, how, if a kid, I watched Vandegrift post a video. I think Joe posted a video one time, either last year or this year. And somebody commented, is like, these kids seem like they have a full understanding of sound.
Yeah.
And in a drumline, like, drumlines are just going to continue to get better and better. That's why drum corps has taken this whole leap in playing ability, and how young kids are becoming virtuosic at rudimental playing, because they understand, like, to achieve that sound, you have to be relaxed. And to be relaxed, you have to have the right technique. I mean, the Rennick truthers in the concepts that we get from all these top dogs like Mike Jackson or Paul Rennick or Colin McNutt is like, they somehow along the way figured out how do we achieve that sound. It's not about notes anymore.
That's cool.
I'm
super out of the loop on this, because I used to pay a lot more attention to drumline stuff than I have lately. I was always a big Tom Unks fan, because two of my best pals March Cadets, in the 2000s. So that was always just like my default. But yeah, it's very interesting to me. I remember sitting there at BOA thinking, like, I would make any of these drum lines. You know, like, there's no way.
Oh, I don't. I wouldn't either, to be honest.
I mean, the way I played, I watched, sort of watched recently one of my high school, you know, 1997 when I was a freshman in high school. And my God, the stuff we were playing, we were a good marching band for New York. We were state champs and stuff. I mean, the stuff we were playing was a joke, you know, I mean, like, hilarious compared to what's going on now. And you're right, it is. And I think critics would argue, you know, that that's always been kind of a missing piece. It's like, well, are these kids playing musically, or are they just learning this one thing? And, you know, but then I watched the Vandegrift Wind Ensemble at Midwest play absolutely as musical as can be, you know, so tasteful. And our good pal, George Clements, I don't know if you've ever met him before, but if you haven't, you should. He teaches near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Really great program. Small schools and small, you know, small size program, but that's something that he puts such an emphasis on. It's like, he gets these kids to play in the marching band, and the drum line's great, front ensemble's great, but then their percussion ensemble's great too, you know, and they can play stuff that's tasteful. And like, we did the premiere of, Ivan wrote this piece, Scattered and Together, and it's for drum set and percussion ensemble. Yeah, and I played the drum set the first time with George's students a couple of years back. And it was like, you know, it was like playing with pros. And they were, some of these kids were like 13, you know, they just really got it.
You're like,
so I'm glad that the two worlds are marrying a bit, because
they are.
It used to be, you know, that was always the thing when George and Bobby Marino, and they were going to do cadets, you know, leaving from Eastman to go to cadets camp, and, you know, people always give them a hard time, like, well, make sure you don't forget how to play music when you come back, you know. And that's, they're two of the finest musicians that I know, so I'm not worried about them. But that was always the thing, you know. I remember even like John Beck tapping on somebody had brought a Yamaha like marching snare into a practice room. He's like, this doesn't sound, there's no tone to this drum, you know, and she's like kind of laughing. It's like, that's sort of what a lot of people are doing right now. And, you know, because where he's coming from, out of the older tradition and stuff, and it's just cool to see like kind of all of it, sort of everything getting to know each other in the pot, so to speak, right? Like, that's good that these things are congealing in a way. I think it's cool.
It's becoming less militaristic, which was the intent from the beginning. There's these guys that are at the top of the game, instructor wise, they're artists. They are.
Yeah.
And to the truest extent, and like, I think outside of the southern states and outside of the marching world, marching percussion gets a lot of hate. But you gotta understand, you're getting kids to, nowadays, you're getting kids to understand that they're doing something creative, artistic, in its own way now. Like, it's not just about playing football games anymore. Yeah, and some of the things, like, there's this marching show that went around Facebook from a Texas high school band, and people are calling it the greatest high school marching band show ever. And I don't remember the name of the school. It starts with a B, and somebody listening to this is screaming at the stereo right now. But
it wasn't like the Broken Arrow, right?
It wasn't Broken Arrow. It was another school.
Not a lot of B's that I'm familiar with.
Yeah, but
Beaumont, I know it's out there.
Beaumont's, that's an interesting town. But it was floating around, and you begin to think, like, from what this was intentionally supposed to be, is whereas like drum corps was like a bunch of war vets coming back from World War and being like, let's keep on doing the thing that
let's play,
and now it's become a visual experience. People are gonna hate on the visual thing.
So here's my one thing, though. I do have like a point of contention on this, because I sat there and watched these bands for, you know, 3 days. I wasn't there the whole time, but I saw a lot of really the top bands, and,
right,
you know, Avon and Carmel and all these great groups. And I do have a couple problems with it, because number one, if your school doesn't have any money, you can't do that.
No.
You know, there are bands that were there at BOA that have $1 million budgets for the year.
Yeah.
That's not possible in some places. And so I don't think that's really healthy if we're talking about equity, right? Like like to see more opportunities based on what people can achieve without having to have, you know, $1 million budget, right? Don't get me wrong. Groups are incredible. There's a lot of value that they're adding to the artistic community, I think.
But you just have to luck into that euphoric state. Like,
right. you gotta, it's more than luck. I mean, you gotta be born and live in the right area code, right? But the other thing I think that is maybe even more, if you wanted to be like the anti-marching band guy, is that like so much of it depends on the adults, right? Like so much of it depends on the adults. Can you still hear me? I think one of my AirPods died.
No, yeah, I can still hear you.
Okay, cool. Yeah, one of them died, but one of them is cool. It's so much about the grownups, right? So like if you don't have the great drill designer and the good composer and the right teachers and, you know, like so much of it. Like I don't think I saw any mistakes when I sat there watching semifinals at BOA. So it wasn't about what the kids were doing. They had already kind of like reached the maximum potential. The difference between first and second and fifth was mostly about who had created this and the
choice,
kids don't
creative
really,
choices. Yeah.
Yeah. And the kids don't really have any say in that at all. Right. They're sort of just like executing the plan.
Yeah. They get their doc book.
No different than high school football. Right. I mean, well, even then though, the quarterback does get to decide who to pass it to, right? So I don't know. I mean, those are the things that I'd love to see at least like talked about more, because I don't think anybody ever talks about that I'm aware of, you know, talks about those issues of equity. And like, it's about like, I think what the adults do is incredible, man. Like, I think that some of those designs and, you know, some friends I talk to that are on some of those staffs, I won't name them by name, but like some of the things that people told me about the way that the level of thought and the level of detail that they put into those show designs is mind-blowing. On par with any other artistic endeavor, I would say.
Right.
But just because you live in the right town, you know, then you get to experience that. And if you live in the next town over, you might not get to experience that. I don't know if there's something that doesn't sit right with me about putting all, I mean, and like state to state, like New York State, where I live, the best marching band in New York State, I think, you know, wouldn't make semifinals at BOA.
Well,
most years.
It's about weather too.
All of our school districts are so much smaller. Like I used to teach in the 10th largest school district in New York State. We had four high schools.
Yeah.
That was the 10th largest. And like New York City, Rochester City, Buffalo City, Albany City, you know, those were the top, whatever. I taught in one of the largest suburban districts. And then you look at a school district like Houston, you know, where there are, I don't know how many high schools, but there's more than four.
I mean, that's not even counting the biggest suburban areas, like Cypress has 12.
Right, right.
And,
or like I love to think about all the folks in Leander, where like they have every high school marching band is better than, like, you know, any of the ones that are up here.
Yeah.
That's incredible to me.
Well, there's an aspect to teaching in the state and having the position that I have, which is a percussion director.
Yeah.
I'm only responsible for that. The fact that there's funding for that in the state is already. But on top of that, like, people don't understand what these top programs have at their disposal. They have the funds to not only fund their full-time staff, but a private lesson staff. They have enough funds to provide, to pay for the lessons for the students in the private lesson staff.
Well, how about instruments, right?
I mean, instruments.
The equipment, uniforms, all the stuff that goes into it. Transportation. And
they're vertically aligned, not only financially, but they're vertically aligned philosophically, and they have great resources and teachers and a curriculum in place from the second that student walks in that sixth grade band hall. And it's become that. It's become a monster in which only a few districts are able to achieve based on socioeconomics, based on location. It's a whole other realm that, unfortunately, like, bands probably 95% of the bands in Texas are going to have to just do what they can. Whereas some people, the sky's the limit. And those are the ones that are setting the tone.
And I'm not saying like, let's take away from any of these places that are doing it so great. I mean, I work a lot with schools in Texas with my position for Hal Leonard. I think it's amazing. I wish everybody could get more of that sort of philosophy, but you know, there is a financial aspect in play as well. And so, you know, I guess people always say to me, like, I have this conversation, I feel like I'm a lot, you know, and I kind of have become, it's been something that matters a lot to me. And, you know, so people are like, Claire, so what are you going to do? You know, like, what are you going to do? They have $1 million. How are you going to fix that? I think just being aware of it is step one.
Yeah.
You know, and starting to thinking about opportunities for groups, you know, maybe it means you change the score sheet, or maybe you change the way that they're classified so that there's a group, you know, that you can get to the finals in BOA and you're from a Title I school district. You know, like, I would love to see some of that stuff. There used to be a band in town, I think they were from Buffalo. I can't remember, but they, you know, they would go to these marching band shows and have just a different style. You know, they were a more urban school district, and they, you know, modeled some of what they did after some of the HBCU marching band programs, which was awesome. And they couldn't be competitive at the competitions because like the rules were set up for this certain like DCI-esque sort of groups, and they were doing things differently. And it was like, man, but they're like entertaining, and like everybody would like love when they would perform because it was so much fun.
Right.
But they would be like 20 points behind some of the other groups and get all these penalties and stuff. And then, you know, some kids would make fun of it and be like, oh, they're horrible. Like, they're not horrible. They're just not fitting into the mold that's been set up here.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so I guess that's the thing. It's like systemic change. If people think about that, and we think about it as a community, that's the kind of thing that we want to be supportive of, is providing opportunities for as many kids as possible to have that great experience. Because I know that when a kid graduates from the Avon High School marching band, whether they go into music or not, they have skills that are going to make them successful in life that they learn from being a part of that program.
100%.
Right?
I mean,
no question. So let's give all the kids that we can those skills, you know, because now those kids who already, you could argue, had a leg up on things by living in this affluent community, now have another leg up because they've learned all these skills that are transferable to business and finance and being, you know, what we would consider in America successful. Meanwhile, the student from the next town that doesn't have that, you know, they can't maybe afford to live in that affluent community, now is not going to walk away with those skills either. It's like this cycle where it's how is that person supposed to compete, you know, compete like for a trophy, but in the world, right?
You said though, it's about the grown-ups though. I mean, like,
it is about the grown-ups.
If let's say they're at a small school with one band director, that band director may not have that concept in their own life. And it's like,
right.
And if I have always been taught that in my music education degree, especially, where they were like, you have to teach these kids, you're not going to teach them like they're all going to wind up being career musicians. Right. If they walk away with an appreciation of it and they became a better citizen from it, then you did your job. Because
right.
At the end of the day, like, I've been a part of a staff that, like a BOA staff, a very successful BOA staff in Vegas. And those kids were in euphoria and they had no idea. And I had to stop them one time and I was like, you guys are freshmen and sophomores and I'm teaching you guys about musical concepts. I'm not teaching you how to hold the stick. I'm not teaching you any of this. You guys get that. You guys don't understand how lucky you are and how much you're going to carry this on into your professional lives, like, or even your everyday life is going to be like,
just everything, time management,
yeah,
disciplines, and, you know, and it's crazy, man, like how deep it goes. Because when I was a department coordinator, you know, we were trying to hire people or even like interview people that had similar socioeconomic backgrounds to our students. And we were hard pressed to even find a person of color who could apply to be a music teacher. And then I would start asking my friends that taught in colleges around. I said, do you have any students of color that are working towards being music educators? And well, the answer was a lot of times no, because to get into the music ed program, you have to reach a certain level of performance. And to reach that certain level of performance, you probably needed private lessons. And if you were coming from a background that where you couldn't afford private lessons, then you were already not set up for success, right?
Right.
And so it's like, I get to this point in the conversation always, and I feel so tired out. I'm like, man, I was really lucky. I had everything I needed all through life. I mean, we weren't rich, but I never was without. And, you know, I always had a ride to concerts, and I always had a ride home, and I always had a tuxedo if that's what we needed, and decent mallets and lessons and everything. And it's like, man, I just feel like it's that we do have a lot of growing to do in education and music, especially in finding ways to support all students, you know, support all who want to participate, even from day one. You know, like schools will say, well, you know, if a kid can't afford an instrument, they can ask for one. And it's like, yeah, because do you like up here, we start in fourth grade. Like, are you in fourth grade going to go up to your band teacher and be like, hey, man, I'm too poor to rent a clarinet?
Right.
Like, what a mature, well, imagine the level of maturity that student would have to be able to self-advocate at that level. And a lot of times the teachers just forget about that and say, like, well, if they need help, they would ask for it. Like, no, not necessarily.
And their parents wouldn't necessarily ask for it either. Like,
or perhaps they can't, you know,
right.
Perhaps they're working two jobs, or they're, you know, single parents, or there are just so many reasons why from day one, students who have certain advantages are ahead, you know, and that's why when you look around I still consider myself an educator, though I'm not a school teacher right now, but when you look at the educator community, there's not a lot of diversity still. And you know, we composers the same way, you know, like there's not a lot of diversity in the music that was played at Midwest. You know, it's getting better. I'll give that. But you know, my students, when I taught, we had a really diverse group of kids, and they wanted to play music that was composed by people who looked like they did and who came from similar places. And we did, but it wasn't always easy. You know, it wasn't always as readily available as, you know, pieces by white male composers. So, I mean, this could be its own separate episode, man.
Well,
just go down this whole thing, but it's just, I always try, if I ever have a platform, try to, you know, remind people that this is something that we should think about, at least, you know, in the percussion world. Like, if we're not so worried about having the right mallet, maybe we just learn how to play with the one that we have, you know, to bring it back to what we talked about at the beginning. Like, any sticks can do, you know, like, let's learn to play a role or whatever, you know, whatever you're going to do. So, I don't know, I just hope that we can, as a community, continue to grow in that area and support as many kinds of learners and situations as we can, because, you know, everybody deserves a shot, but you also, you never know what people are capable of until they have that chance.
Well, somebody like Ivan broke down barriers already just being from his heritage and from the beautiful music he writes, on top of, you know, people like Joe Moore, and, you know, Kevin Day, who just wrote a beautiful new vibraphone piece that I was on the commission for.
Oh,
and
nice. Yeah, I like his music too.
People like that are who set the tone by not only, you know, who they are, but like by their merit of the works that they put out. And if we kind of just, I think overall everybody's mindset's changing anyway.
I agree.
And I think to be more aware of it as a society and as a music community already is a step in the right direction, because you never really thought about that. And like you said, this could be a whole separate podcast, but I just wanted to promote, I wanted to promote those guys in particular, because I love their music and Joe and I, we've been meaning to do a podcast. Joe, if you're listening, let's get it going, please.
Yeah.
Because I want to get you on here and we need to talk. But yeah.
Yeah, you know. he had a piece that that they played at a PASIC that was great. I don't remember what it was called, but the Oliver Molina's group played this piece, and boy, I loved his piece. That was great.
Yeah.
But, you know, like Ivan, man, like, you know, he's one of my very best friends, and like I've been to his dad's barber shop, you know, in Victoria, Texas.
Yeah.
And he worked, and his parents worked hard, you know, for everything that he's got. But yeah, he's, you know, he's done a lot for the community, and you know, I think that just like keeping, like you're saying, you know, keeping it in mind and like trying whenever we can to make choices that will support folks in whatever way we can, you know, I think that's the key, you know, that's the start.
Yeah.
And like being intentional about it, you know, like programming music for the, like you making sure that we're programming music by composers of color and by female composers and by all, you know, all sorts. And then making sure that we're doing everything we can to encourage those kids to be in our programs too. You know, like you can go to a really diverse high school and in a lot of cases go into the band room and not see that same level of diversity reflected in the kids playing instruments, right? Mm-hmm. That's a problem. You know, we have to find ways to reach all those students as much as we can and find, you know, going into communities in Rochester, you know, the east side of town is very affluent and those groups have, you know, 60 person concert bands. And then you go across town where there's less affluence and there might be 30 students in the concert band, same size high school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like we need to do more to create opportunities. And so I think we're saying the same thing, but it's important, I think. And if folks who are listening haven't already started to think about that, and I'm no expert, right? Like, I mean, I'm sure there are things I'm forgetting and saying incorrectly, and if that's true, I apologize. But I think, like, as long as everybody's trying their best, I think that's a great starting place. And just having these conversations is so good for, you know, improvements. And hopefully we can do another one in 10 years and talk about all the things that are so much better now and all the opportunities that have been created.
I mean, yeah. the only that's the only way we're going to be able to see that is having these conversations that I think people in general society have a lot of these conversations, like podcasts like Rogan or Lex Fridman, Michael Malice, like all these guys that have their philosophy is about general society, not about a specific community of it, but music and arts is crucial to their conversations. Why can't we just go ahead and just elaborate on those conversations, those mini conversations? But
like, you know, Rogan has a lot of money that he could be very influential with if he chose to, you know, so like, let's go support those communities, you know, let's find ways to support young entrepreneurs from, you know, communities that are underserved. You know, I'd like to see people who have that means, you know, put your money where your mouth is a little bit more. Talking about it's cool. Doing it is really cool too, though, you know, having that influence. So yeah, I think you're right though. I mean, I think that a lot of things are headed in the right direction. I think COVID really like squelched a lot of momentum that was happening with certain things.
Right.
In that regard. But, you know, I'm hopeful that that people just keep on considering this stuff and pushing to make change. And it's hard because, you know, the thing that I think is hardest about it for folks is that if I'm trying to promote composers of color, then that means that my music might get played a little bit less because I'm not a composer of color, and I've got to be okay with that, you know? And I think that's a pretty big thing for some folks to be okay with, right? Because we all want our music to be successful. We all want our concerts to be successful. You know, I try really hard, even like I think about musicians that I hire for a gig or something. I try to include, you know, as much diversity as I can because I think it's important. You know, it's important to have, especially in jazz, like such a male dominated culture for so many years, and it's getting so much better. but it's still, there are a lot of things that are very male dominated, and more white dominated too, because it's all the, well, not all, but a lot of the jazz, you know, upcoming stars are products of music school. And it goes back to the same conversation we had, like, how do you get into music school? You have to have a lot of things go right before you can get there for you. And so, you know, I have a lot of respect for all the folks of color that are really thriving in the face of a lot of opposition, I think, you know, right, in terms of the jazz world especially. So, you know, just doing our best we can to support everyone, especially those who would benefit from a little extra support, I think is what we got to do. So I'm glad that we're on the same page with that.
Absolutely. There's going to be more discussion on this stuff, and there needs to be, yeah, more recorded and documented discussion stuff. And I have no problem being the one who facilitates that, because this is not just about sticks hitting things. It's
right.
It's not about the music being made sometimes. The art comes from a response to how society is operating and what is happening, oh, yeah, in society. And so I think more so recently, just based on what's happened in my life in recent times, that I've really started to look at things like that, where,
okay,
how am I responding as an artist to what's going on? What kind of output am I creating? And I think that's one thing that a community of artists needs to make note of.
Yeah, man. And I think we also need to make sure that the people that are that we're talking about have a seat at the table and a seat in the conversation, correct, too, because it's nice for you and I to talk about what should happen for Black artists, but there's also something like we all should listen to what some Black artists have to say about it too,
right,
because that, for obvious reasons, their opinion is integral to that discussion. You know, it's not up to us to decide. So, yeah, it's also a good thing to remember, just to like hold space for folks. And I'm really trying hard to not come across as an expert, because I'm not. You know, but I do care a lot about it, and I think that I want to do my part to, like I said, when I have a chance to, you know, I don't know how many thousands or millions of people listen to these podcasts that you've got here, but
hundreds of millions, actually. But
yeah, you know, hundreds of counting? Millions. I think it's like actually like 200 million.
Yeah.
Thousand or something. I don't know.
It's Rogan numbers, but you know.
Yeah, for sure. But anyway, you know, I think that that's important to me, just to say like, hey man, I'm just trying my best here, like I think everybody is. So, you know, yeah, providing people with grace is good, and you know, providing people an opportunity to learn is good, and I've got a lot of learning to do too. So, you know, well, happy to listen to that stuff.
We've already got the ball rolling, man. I can't thank you enough for joining me today.
Oh man, this has been so much fun. I love thinking about stuff and talking about stuff, and
me too.
Yeah, so, that's great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll do it again sometime, maybe.
Yeah, I think we're already going to do that, and
yeah,
it's going to be a good one. And so, Aaron, you do you want to plug anything? Do you want to talk about anything?
I guess I plug my TikTok, right?
Yeah.
Aaron Stabell, STAEBELL drums. I did a podcast a couple weeks ago with Brandon Arvey, another great percussionist, and he challenged me to do 30 days of TikToks
of
drumming. So I'm doing it, and I think I'm up to like day 6 or something like that. It's going okay.
Yeah,
it's harder than it looks.
You're a TikToker now.
Well, I guess I got like 30 views. But I'm going to start to chronicle the process of this album that I'm working on my TikTok. So that's at least my big plan. I would plug the album, but it's not a thing yet. But
okay,
TikTok will show you the way.
And let's plug the TikTok first.
I've got like aaronstabellmusic.com, and you have to be careful not to go to aaronstabell.com, because I let it lapse. Like, I didn't renew it, and it got bought by like an Asian pornography website. So
okay, well,
if you go to aaronstabell.com, it's a not safe for work. Not doesn't have anything to do with me anymore.
Thank you for the
I tried to get it back, but it did not work out. No, so aaronstabellmusic.com is the website that you might visit. And you know, there's I've got a Bandcamp that has some of my records on it that if anybody wants to listen to, it would be cool. But and just buy as much Hal Leonard products as you can possibly do too.
Good old, what'd you call him? Uncle Hal.
Uncle Hal. Yeah. It's a great place though, great company, and I think they're doing all the right things too.
Yeah.
In regards to the stuff we're talking about. So happy to support those who support me in my job.
There you go. And you can I'll put all this links in the description below for the TikTok and for the Bandcamp and that good stuff, and not aaronstabell.com, but aaronstabell.com.
Definitely not. I mean, some people might like it, but it just isn't, it's just not what you think.
You're right.
You know,
but you can follow me at Hartwell Drums on Instagram. You can follow the podcast, Rudimental Podcast, Instagram at the Rudimental Pod. You can support this podcast in the link below. You've already heard an ad about it in the middle of this episode, but yeah. This has been a really great episode, and I can't thank you enough, Aaron, for joining me.
Man, thank you. It's so much fun. Yeah, I'm going to go get some dinner with my kids and my wife now, I think.
There you go. That's how we do it. All right. That's it for this one. Right. We'll see y'all next time. All right, man.